Just see some of you again today. Maybe last time was not what some people expected, so they weren't able to come today. Or is it just very hot? So we're going to continue today on this discourse on the Four Noble Truths. But before I begin, before we do a little meditation to set our motivation, let me give a little space for questions. And I'll give space in the middle and at the end of the talk also, because some questions might arise during the talk. But if there's any questions that you have lingering from last time, or general Dharma questions, now's a chance to ask some of them. I don't know if I'll be able to answer, but I'll try. Does anyone have a question? Okay, maybe that's good. Or maybe that's bad, I don't know. If you don't have questions, either you understand completely or you're completely confused, so you don't know whether to ask. Anyone? Okay. So let's begin by trying to do a prelude to our time together today. By calming the mind, and one of the most powerful things, as we mentioned last time, powerful methods to do that is to pay attention to be mindful of your respiration. Not to control it. That might even take, even if you've done for some time, it may take you a little time to recall how to let go and just watch, and just be an observer of your breathing. Watch it coming in, watch as it changes direction and begins to very slowly go out, and then the stream gets stronger. And at the end also how it begins to, you know, you have expelled all of the breath that is naturally going to be expelled that time within normal breathing, and just changes and begins to come in again. If you can hold your attention to this, that can help to prevent the mind from following the various thoughts that we've been following up till now this morning, on the bus, in the car, you know, down the street, your plans and your worries and so forth. So just, you'd like to be able to find just a very calm state of mind. So let's do that for a couple of minutes. Sit comfortably with your back erect and commence in being mindful of your respiration. as you begin to observe the general outline of the breathing, the object that you're concentrating on, begin to increase your attention. We call it squeezing attention, although not squeezing your body, no tension in your body. Just ratchet up your attention. Split your attention between the thoughts that might be rising in your mind and the breathing. Just let them go. Discard them, the thoughts. Remind yourself you can think about them later. Just focus on the breathing. Tend to just watch the beginning of a cycle of breath, like an inhalation, and then let your mind wander off into other thoughts until it changes direction. Watch the whole cycle, or at least a couple of cycles. See if you can go to another level of your awareness of the breathing. So let go of your attention to the breathing and turn your attention instead to your mental consciousness. What is that? That's the entity that thinks, that has thoughts, that plans, and so forth. You can go through your senses, say, I'm not going to pay attention to the eye consciousness, and maybe for a minute with your eyes just slightly open, recognize the eye consciousness. That's not the one you're going to be paying attention to. Not your ear consciousness, through which you're listening to these comments, so it's functioning. There may be some rumble of an air conditioner or a fan in the background, or street noise, or people as they come in and out. You're not going to pay attention to that. Maybe more dominant. Not your nose consciousness. Can you smell anything right now? It's kind of a neutral smell. Not going to pay attention to that. Not your tongue consciousness. Which experiences tastes and so forth. Not your body consciousness. Which is perhaps right now cognizant of the general presence of your body. You're sitting, maybe a slight tension in your hips if you're not balanced properly on the cushion, or some residual pain, or itching or something in your body. You're not going to pay attention to that, but to the mental consciousness. Thinks. See if you can listen to the chatter that's going on there without getting involved. Like sitting at a cafe where other people are having conversations and turning your attention to those conversations, listening, but not paying attention to the details of them. Itself, like a bubble rising to the surface, or sometimes they're instigated by some external cause, like paying attention to a sound. However these thoughts appear to the mind, they all seem to be as though they were objects within a vast space of the mental consciousness. Objective thoughts. So turn your attention away from paying attention to the thoughts themselves, but instead just pay attention around the thoughts, the consciousness to which they're appearing. Consciousness that knows them. That consciousness has the quality of cognizing the object, knowing it, but also has a quality of being clear and spacious. Allowing thoughts to come, allowing them to go. This is what is sometimes called the clear light nature of the mind. concentrate on it rather than on the objective thoughts. Let go of the thoughts, the input to your senses, the input to your mind, and just concentrate on the nature of the mind itself. And as the thoughts begin to fade, doesn't have any form to sort of act with friction on the thoughts, slow them down, capture them. Not like that. Thoughts might have some lifespan in our mind, might last for some time. It's partially because of the fact that we're paying some attention to them. If you let go of your attention to the thoughts, they begin to dissipate and disappear. And you're left with that spaciousness of the mind that was knowing them, has the capacity to know, and that is clear, spacious, unobstructing. Knowing this nature is actually there in our mind. This is our, sometimes called our conventional Buddha potential. It's a clear light nature of the mind. We can let go of the negative states of mind, our negative habits, reactions with anger and attachment, defense, defending our ego. And we can replace them with positive states of mind. Because the mind has this clear light nature. Anger, attachment, jealousy, pride, all of these states of mind are perhaps not objective thoughts. They do have objective thoughts that they are holding in a certain way. But these states of mind are not of the very nature of the mind. They're not constantly there. They too can be removed from the mind. For listening to me, participating in the talk this morning, one that takes into consideration the multitude, the numberless beings outside of ourself that sometimes we're unaware of, sometimes we like to ignore. All of them in this world, other world systems, way out into the galaxies of space, numberless world systems where sentient beings exist, some of them as humans right now, some of them are experiencing other life forms as animals, spirits, some are experiencing the excruciating sufferings of the hell realms. Others are blissed out, totally feeling incredible pleasure in the God realms. But all of those existences are impermanent. Those lives will end. All of those beings have been, in the past, intimately related to us. They've all been our mothers, our friends. Numberless times, and have helped us again and again, nurtured us in kindness, taken care of us, given their bodies and their lives for us to protect us. And for their welfare, I'm going to listen to the teachings this morning. Pay attention. Because by so doing, with the motivation of concern for others, and with the intention to try to develop myself, my positive qualities, eliminate my negative faults, to become a less of a problem for other living beings. Sometimes we say mother sentient beings. Less of a problem for mother sentient beings, and to become someone actually positive who can actually lead them out of suffering. I think for that purpose I'm going to participate in the teachings this morning, not just to accumulate information, but to get incrementally closer to a state where I'm free of faults that can be harmful to others and can be harmful to myself, anger, attachment, jealousy, and so forth. Incrementally closer to a state where I can exhibit great love and generosity, compassion, with the courage to take on the suffering of others. That state of mind is possible. It's what we call enlightenment. All capable of it. We all have that nature to achieve enlightenment. So for that purpose, to achieve enlightenment for the sake of others, I'm going to participate this morning. Your meditation. It's okay? Any observation? Singaporeans, I notice, generally at first don't want to say, but later the Japanese are even more so. Are you familiar? Anyone here Japanese? When I was teaching in Tokyo once, I asked people if they had any questions, and no one would venture any question. All through the seminar, it was like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday sort of thing. At the end of the seminar, they came to me and they said, "Bante, we would like to have a party at the end. Is it okay?" I said, "Well, generally it's not the general Buddhist tradition, but it's okay, okay." And they said, "But Bhante, we would like to have sake at the party." I said, "Well, that's not generally Buddhist." But they said, "But Bhante, we always have sake." So, okay, so a little bit of sake. So well, I noticed that during their little party, when they passed the sake around, they became very loquacious, and they asked so many questions, sometimes, very frank So at moments like this, when people are a little bit shy to ask questions, I say, just pass the sake. And feel uninhibited if you have some question that you kind of would like to ask, but you're a little bit shy. Just imagine you've had a sip of imaginary sake. Okay. Anyone? Okay. Yes. Oh, good. Okay. Is nirvana permanent or impermanent, right? What do you think? Did we say last time? Impermanent? Impermanent. Oh, permanent. I'm just teasing you. So why is it permanent? All things are of two kinds. They're either impermanent or permanent. So if we can rule out something as being impermanent, it would have to be permanent. If we can rule out something as being permanent, like say for instance, ourselves, we can rule out the person being permanent because we know we change. Sometimes we're happy, sometimes we're sad, we grow old, or hair changes color, or whatever. So we must be impermanent. Now, nirvana is an example of what we call cessation. Remember the Four Noble Truths? What was the third truth? Truth of cessation, right? And that means cessation of what? Suffering and the causes of suffering. Not just suffering, but because you might imagine suffering has ceased for a short time, but also the causes of suffering. So if the causes of if suffering has ceased and the causes that give rise to new suffering has also ceased, if they are also ceased, then we won't experience any suffering in the future, right? If temporarily you have ceased suffering, but you haven't eliminated the causes of suffering, it might seem like for a short time, oh, I'm okay, I'm super man, I'm super woman, must have achieved nirvana or whatever. But if you have not ceased the causes of the delusions and the causes of suffering, which are, remember what the causes are? Do you? Karma and afflictions, right? Karma and klesha. I like the KK, the two, in Sanskrit, those two both begin with it. Karma means actions, and it's our actions that we've done, positive and negative actions, even neutral actions, that leave an imprint in the mind, kind of a seed, that is the direct cause of our happiness or suffering. In the case of suffering, it's the negative actions we've done, the direct cause. But what's the cause of that karma? It's the kleshas that motivated it, the afflictions, the afflictive states of mind. On a set of lectures that will start, I think, on Tuesday, we're going to be talking about the mind, how it functions, and the afflictions and so forth. If you have any interest in delving into that, I believe that's in the evenings and on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So there's a little more grist for the mill. Do you say that here in Singapore? Grist for the mill? You know, sort of a maybe old English expression. When you have a mill, you put some kind of things, you know, the raw grains into it, and you grind. So if you don't have anything to put in, you're not going to get any flour out, right? You have to put some grist in grains, old, you know, the shells and everything, and you grind it, and you get the flour out. So cessation means the cessation, the ending of some suffering and some of the afflictions so that they will never come back again. So there are various degrees of cessation. When you begin to cease the afflictions, you don't cease them all at once so they'll never come back. When you have a direct perception of reality, we call emptiness, the ultimate nature of all things. And that's something that's perhaps somewhere in the distance for us right now. We won't have that for some time. First, we have to get a general intellectual understanding of what emptiness means, hold it single-pointedly, clarify our understanding of it. But at a certain point, we will realize it barely, like the way that you see things without any kind of sort of veil between you and it, without any kind of film or mental image between you and the object. When you do that, at first, a certain number, a certain degree of the afflictions will be ceased. It's not a random number. It doesn't depend on your own personal experience, but what are called the intellectually formed afflictions, the ones that are based on wrong assumptions, they will be ceased so that they will never come back. So something which has ceased such that it will never come back, it's not as though you've, for instance, in the garden, if you cut off plants at ground level with a cutter, machete, or scythe, or something, knife, you might think, oh, I got rid of all the weeds, right? But it rains a couple of days later, there's sunny, more rain, and then you notice from that spot that you thought you had cut them off, they're starting to come up again, because you didn't get them from the root. So when the delusions have been ceased, that means they have been uprooted from their very root. So there's nothing to give rise to them again. So that kind of cessation is permanent. If you've only cut them off temporarily with a temporary antidote, like, say, cutting them off, like cutting off the plant, you know, and you haven't eliminated them from the root, they will arise again. So, but true cessation is one in which you have uprooted them. In what sense? Because the very cause, the life force of those afflictions is rooted in our conception of ourself as being real and findable. It's rooted in an apprehension of ourself as being inherently existent. That is to say, not merely some very nebulous kind of sense of the self that's changing, that's designated to your body and mind, but something really solid, really there. When you've realized that directly for the first time, some of those afflictions are uprooted so they'll never come back. Over time, as you meditate on emptiness again and again, over a long period of time, more and more of the delusions are uprooted. And when you reach a certain state, only left a certain number of the afflictions, the most subtle ones that were most difficult to remove. Once those are removed through your meditation, you have reached nirvana. Passed beyond sorrow. Up till then, you might have still had some subtle sufferings and causes of some new subtle sufferings. Excuse me. But when you reach nirvana, all of them are totally ceased. So there's two things. You would ask, is nirvana permanent? So nirvana is an example of a particular kind of cessation where all of the afflictions have been removed. And each and every one of those individual cessations of the various stages of eliminating the afflictions, all of them are permanent. So the state of nirvana is also permanent. All of the causes that would give rise to you creating, for instance, karma, to be born in the hell realms or as an animal, those karmas have long since been ceased, much, much earlier along that path when you've realized emptiness. So there's no chance of being reborn without you wishing to do so, because bodhisattvas, for instance, can take rebirth. Even higher bodhisattvas who've eliminated all of the afflictions from their mind, they can still take rebirth, but not through the way that we take rebirth, uncontrolled. They sort of like decide where they want to go. Does anyone here ever have to go in your companies or something? Do you ever have to go on vacation to a place the company decides or the Singaporean government decides? You do? Where do you have to go? So that's example of us now. You know, we don't get to choose our destination next life, right? But when you get freedom, you become like a full-fledged Singaporean who can say, "Excuse me, I'm not going there. I'm going to Las Vegas. I'm going to where I want to go." You know, so you no longer are under the influence of any power when you've reached nirvana. Okay. Does that help a little bit? Anyone else have a question? Yes. Speak up a little. If you're Minnie, I'm not sure if you're Minnie. Are you Minnie? No, that's not your name. Okay. Yeah. You can just project. Yes.
Hello. Yeah. Okay. So this is better, right? So thank you, Venerable, for your sharing.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, following from that question about impermanence or permanent, is Buddha a permanent being or impermanent being? Because I know Buddha is made up of the three kayas.
Mm.
Yeah. So I'm not very sure, because I think some parts of it is impermanent, some part of it is permanent.
Okay. So you said the Buddha is made up of three kayas. Generally we say, if you say three kayas, generally you're saying dharmakaya, nirmanakaya, and sambhogakaya, generally, right? So actually, sometime earlier in the different teachings, sometimes they say the Buddha has two kayas, dharmakaya and rupakaya. You know the word rupa is part of the Singaporean language? Rupa, form, right? But do you know it because it's used in Singaporean language, or you just know it because of Dharma studies? Rupa. It's an Indian word, right? But I mean, there's a lot of things incorporated into our languages that come from Indonesian, which came from Sanskrit originally. So Rupa means form, and sometimes the statues, when you, if you were to look at statues, you say, oh, that's a very fine Rupa. Physical representation, form. So the body, the Buddha has two kinds of aspects, his mental aspect, the dharmakaya, and the rupakaya, the physical manifestations. If you divide the rupakaya up, and there the kind of aspect that appears to the world as a universal teacher or in other forms, is what's called the rupakaya, is what's called the nirmanakaya, emanation body, like Shakyamuni Buddha. So that's obviously not permanent, because the Buddha, you know, grew up, took the aspect of changing and searching for the Dharma and so forth, so that you could just remember what I said before, if you could exclude something being permanent. If you could exclude it, yeah, it's changing, so you know that it's impermanent. That so it's not permanent. And the other form body is what's called the Sambhogakaya. So that Sambhogakaya is what's called the enjoyment body. That particular kind of emanation of the Buddha is one that does not appear to ordinary beings. It appears only to certain bodhisattvas, those who have realized emptiness directly. They can perceive the Sambhogakaya and receive teachings from it. One of the qualities of the Sambhogakaya is that it exists until the end of samsara. So does that mean it's permanent? Yeah, it's permanent, right? It exists till the end of samsara. No. Just because it exists. Our mind exists from now, from beginningless time until now, and our mind stream exists from now until we become enlightened and beyond, till the, you know. So, but our mind is impermanent. So for something to exist till the end of time doesn't mean that it's permanent. What's the deciding factor is if it's changing moment by moment. So the Sambhogakaya gives teachings to these bodhisattvas that have realized emptiness. We call them Arya bodhisattvas. The word Arya, did we mention last time? But word Arya, we said the four Arya truths, the four noble truths. So anyone who is, the Buddha said, anyone who's realized emptiness directly, they are a real noble being. They are a real Arya. So so the Sambhogakaya gives teachings to them. So it has to change moment by moment in order to give those teachings. So the Sambhogakaya is also impermanent. The Dharmakaya, although you might think it's just one thing, it also can be divided into two. Do you know that? What are the two parts of the Dharmakaya? Emptiness of the mind and...
One is the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, and the other one is the mind itself, Buddha's mind itself.
Buddha's mind itself, right?
Yeah, I think.
So we say that one we call the wisdom Dharmakaya, I think it's Jnana Dharmakaya. Jnana is this word that means deeper, not just the prajna, like we talked about perfection of wisdom, prajna paramita, but it's a deeper kind of wisdom. That's the mind that's omniscient, so it knows all phenomena. So if it knows all phenomena, its perception of them must be changing as the phenomena change. So the wisdom Dharmakaya changes moment by moment. In fact, our present mind is deluded as we may feel we are right now, will eventually become, when we become Buddha, will become the Dharmakaya, when all of the stains are eliminated from our mind, when we have ceased, uprooted all of the afflictions through realizing emptiness. But there's another aspect of the Buddha's mind, and that's its ultimate nature. Actually, you could also say there's another aspect of the form body is their ultimate nature, but that's generally not mentioned as a separate body. But the emptiness of the Buddha's mind is called the Svabhavikakaya, the nature body. And that itself is permanent. So there's a little dilemma here. Permanent or impermanent? Yes, permanent parts and impermanent parts. The two bodies are impermanent. The wisdom Dharmakaya is impermanent. But the Svabhavikakaya, the nature of the Buddha's mind, is permanent. Generally, we don't call the Svabhavikakaya, the Buddha's, the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, the nature body, we don't call that Buddha. So if you were to ask, is Buddha permanent or impermanent, generally you would say impermanent. Buddha's changing. But if someone said, but what about this other kind of thing? Oh yeah, the nature of the Buddha's mind is permanent. Just right now, if I were to ask, so your name's not Minnie. That's just written on your shirt, right? What's your name? Kim. So if someone would say, is Kim permanent or impermanent? What would you say? What? Impermanent, right? But then what about the emptiness of Kim? Well, then how could you say Kim is impermanent? Well, generally we don't consider the ultimate nature to be Kim. It's based on the conventional nature. All right. So now the sake has been passed. Does someone else have another question? I noticed you make it a little more easier. The questions. One of the fellows have a question. Let me mention a little bit more about the Four Noble Truths. It's a little background. So when the Buddha was about to be born, when Shakyamuni Buddha was about to be born in the world, his father, king of Kapilavastu, and his future mother, she became pregnant, and they were expecting a child. And the king, before the child was born, asked the ministers, eight ministers, or wise people, I'm not sure if they were Brahmin, I don't think they were actually ministers, it was a Brahmin wise men, asked them to come and to use their powers of intuition and meditation and divination to decide what the fate of this child would be that was about to be born. And there were eight ministers that came, and seven of them, they raised two fingers and they said, either you would become a universal monarch, a Chakravartin, who would have control over not just your kingdom of Kapilavastu, but other kingdoms also. That pleased the king very much. One of the, and they said, or he would become a Buddha, an enlightened being who would lead others, just as a king helps to unify the various peoples, and a virtuous king, and lead them into virtue. A Buddha is someone who, through his own or her own power, is able to lead sentient beings out of suffering. So that didn't please the king as much. He wanted to have what he knew, his own continuity. One of the eight ministers just raised one finger and said, there's no doubt he will become a Buddha. He was the youngest of the ministers. So afterwards, when the young child was born, Siddhartha was born, four of the minister's sons, four of the ministers also had sons who were born to the royal court in Kapilavastu. And the youngest of the ministers, this group of five, so there were four sons and the youngest of the ministers, they lived contemporaneously with Siddhartha as he grew up, took the aspect of seeing these four views from the four gates. Did we talk last time? We saw death, sickness, aging, and what was the other one? He saw a sadhu. You remember? So they were experiencing this around the same time. They saw this. And when he left home secretly and cut off his hair and went off to become a seeker of, wanted to find out what the, what is it? Maybe in modern terminology, they wanted to find the meaning of life. As other people always say, the meaning of life. What is the meaning of life? So he wanted to find out how to escape from samsara, because it was inevitable that there were these sufferings. We all were had suffering of aging, sickness, and death. And that there were some that sought a solution from him, like the sadhu that he saw. So when he left, these four ministers' sons and the youngest of the ministers all followed him, partially maybe with some approval of the kingdom, the king, sort of to guard him. You know, he's gone off. We don't know. We don't go out and find him, take care of him. Does that make sense? You know, whatever he's doing. And so they followed Siddhartha as he went to the various two main teachers that were in India at the time, who taught from the Vedic tradition meditations that could bring you to single-pointed concentration in the form realm, another single-pointed concentration in the formless realm. So they were hanging out with him. And then when he left those two to set out, because he found that the methods that those two teachers proposed would not lead to escape from suffering existence, Siddhartha set out himself to give up the world, the extreme opulence that he'd had before, so to lead an ascetic life, and to try to achieve his own realization. So these five, the four sons and the youngest of the ministers, all followed him. They were his companions in that. How many years did he spend meditating? Yeah. 6 years, right? Yeah. 6 years in ascetic meditation. My teacher, Lama Yeshe, always liked to, he said it was very inspiring to him, that image that you, I think is still in in the museum in Karachi, the fasting Buddha, a very famous sculpture. Bone, very gaunt, not like what the Westerners think of. When people think of Buddha, some ignorant Americans, they think because of the, what is it, the laughing Buddha, what is it called in Chinese? What is it? Milavo. So it's not actually even a Buddha. It's one of the attendants of the arhats, I think, right? Or no? Yeah? Right? Right? You have to say more loudly. Okay, whatever. So not like the big fat belly that you come rub for good luck. You know, people completely misunderstand what Buddhism is about. They think, oh, this is the Buddha, why aren't you fat? You know? The Buddha, during these 6 years of ascetic meditation with the five companions, went to that extreme of living on just a berry a day, so that he was not, the sense of attachment to pleasure was subdued. But he realized during that time that that was not the way to cease attachment, to cease the delusions, simply by ignoring them, simply by depriving of yourself of these pleasures. Sometimes we might think that, you know, that that's a real person's really practicing Buddhism because they don't take any pleasure. You know? Unless you're changing the mind, that deprivation. You know what I mean by deprivation? Depriving yourself of pleasures and ascetic behavior. That is not the middle way. The Buddha finally settled on the middle way between the opulence that he'd experienced before, that all the pleasures of the senses were instantly gratified, and this asceticism that he and the five companions had been trying to do. Just taking food as medicine, taking clothing, just enough to keep the body healthy and so forth. Not to use it as ornamentation and so forth. And when he did so, the other five disciples who had lost faith in him, their minds became sort of antagonistic toward him, and they left to meditate in another place. So, in fact, they traveled eventually to Varanasi in India, and to the particular ground called Deer Park. And when the Buddha did achieve, and Siddhartha did achieve enlightenment on his own, having found the middle way, having realized the Four Noble Truths, that's what he realized in the various watches of the night, on that final night when he achieved enlightenment. And he arose from that after dawn, totally enlightened. At least he took the aspect of this. Again, from a Mahayana point of view, he'd already achieved enlightenment a long time ago, but he took the aspect of this to show others, you know, two extremes of opulence and extreme deprivation, asceticism, were not going to lead you to real satisfaction. But there is a middle way where you utilize food, clothing, shelter, and so forth, just as just enough to keep you alive and healthy and functioning well, and you use your mind to eradicate the delusions. So after some time, the story is more elaborate, but after some time, about a week, he decided to seek out the first two teachers he had to explain to them about the great revelation he had about how to achieve enlightenment, but they had passed on. So then with his clairvoyance, he saw, where are these five disciples, or five companions? They were not yet disciples. They were, in fact, they'd given up on him, right? He realized that they were in Saranath, in Deer Park. So he made his way there. And as he came up to them, as I mentioned last time, they said, oh, here comes Siddhartha, the backslider. The guy who'd given up. We're still strong in our asceticism, you know, we're to pay no attention to him. But by his, just the very aura that he had, he'd become, you know, his body became brilliant and obviously someone of enormous stature. They couldn't help themselves but get up and to offer him a seat. And it's to those five individuals who had been his companions, they became his first five disciples, to whom he taught the Four Noble Truths in the first set of teachings. Just as an interesting factor, have any of you been to the teachings of Geshe Dorje? Some of you, so you've heard Geshe-la was relating this mantra, a sutra that the Buddha taught about the mantra of dependent origination. Remember? Om yed har dharma hetu prabhava hetu tasham. So the traditional interpretation of that, the origin of that, was not that the Buddha proclaimed it in a sutra, but in the Theravada tradition, one of the five disciples, in Pali they call Asaji, Asvajit is the Sanskrit name. Asvajit was one of the five disciples who had achieved, he was the last one to achieve arhatship of the five. He was the slowest of the five. So as he was out looking for alms, not almonds, alms, he was seen by Shariputra, Upatissa, who was not yet the Buddha's disciple. Shariputra and Mahamoggallana. Do we have representations of those two, of the Buddha with the two disciples around him in the Gompa here? No, we have all these other. So there's a very famous Like say for instance, this chunk of Lama Tsongkhapa, right there, yeah. You see on either side of it at the bottom, his two main disciples. It's said that all the Buddhas will always have two main disciples, sort of their right hand and their left hand. And Lama Tsongkhapa had Gelsabche on one side and Kechubche on the other. So Shariputra and Mahamoggallana were two friends that grew up, I think, in the same village. And they, as they grew up, they both decided, we will seek the way to liberation, you know. And if one of us finds it, we'll tell the other. So Shariputra met Asvajit and asked him, you know, you look so... When he was out for alms, it looked so calm and chilled out and, you know, very controlled. He asked him, you must be an arhat, you know, a realized being. Who is your teacher? And Asvajit said, oh, my teacher, the great recluse, or the great, it's a translation of Muni, like we say Shakya Muni, the Muni of the Shakya clan, the great. And a recluse doesn't give the right flavor, sort of like the great lord or the great controlled one. He is my teacher. And they said, Shariputra said, can you give me what teaching? What did he teach? What is his teaching? He said, well, I don't know much, so I better not say anything. And he said, well, if you can condense what he said. And he said, okay. Asvajit thought to himself, these guys are, I better say something. So he said, ye dharma hetu prabhavahatam, you know, prabhavahetu tesham, this phrase that means all, and of those things that are dharmas, of phenomena. The translation in that text was a little bit wrong. It said all dharmas. The Sanskrit doesn't say all dharmas. Of that which is phenomena, which arises, of those phenomena that arise from causes, the Muni has proclaimed those causes, and he's also proclaimed the cessation of those causes. So what was he telling about? He was telling about part of the second noble truth, the causes of suffering, and he was talking about the cessation of suffering. And he was implying the path and implying the truth of suffering. So that's a traditional account of where that verse comes from. And all of the Theravada and even a lot of modern Mahayana, I'm not sure in the Chinese Mahayana, but Geshe-la had pointed out there is a sutra in the Mahayana sutras where Buddha is teaching. And among the people who were present at that discourse, if you look at who's present, who's there? You have it right there? Who's there? It says the Buddha was surrounded by, in the actual sutra. Do you have the sutra there in that book? Right at the very beginning, it says the Buddha was at where... Rajagira or someplace. So it says that he was surrounded by all of his disciples, Shravaka disciples, Bodhisattvas, including Asvajit, the one who tells this story later. So it occurred to me, I wrote to Geshe-la, but he didn't respond yet. I thought, this is interesting. Either Asvajit heard that verse from the Buddha during that discourse, and that discourse took place before Shariputra met Asvajit, or the Buddha, with his clairvoyance, knew this well-explained, inspired verse that Asvajit taught to Shariputra, and he explained from his own omniscience sort of a profound meaning of it. It's not really clear, but it almost looks like that predated, that sutra, from the Mahayana point of view, predates Asvajit's presentation of that verse. So maybe he heard it from the Buddha Anyway, some interesting, maybe not so interesting to you. Those of you who are listening to Geshe-la's teaching, maybe you might find interesting. Yes, you had a question. You can project. I'll repeat your question. If you can make nice loud. You prefer to have that.
The question is, at the Buddha's time, obviously he didn't speak in English, right? Then the sutras that we receive has been translated to modern language. So here
so
we
the Buddha didn't speak English at that time. So aloud. He probably knew, because the Buddha is omniscient and knows all the past, present, and future at one instant. So he certainly knew, you could say he knew English, but he didn't speak English to the people there. They wouldn't understand what he's saying, right?
Okay, the question I have is that when we read the text, here I read it in English because that's the language that I understand best.
Yes.
Then all the teachings says, "Thus did I hear at one time." So my understanding is somebody would have translated. Okay, somebody would have copied the sutras into paper from what they have orally heard, and that's how it became on paper, right? And then whatever language that was recorded over all these years has been translated into the language, so that now, in this time, I'm reading it in English. So the question I have is that when I read it in English, first of all, it depends on my own command of the language to how much I understand what the English is trying to explain to me. Mm-hmm. And when I try to understand the context of the scenario or the situation where they said the Buddha was teaching so and so, it says, "Thus did I heard." So it's like a third person. From what I understand from the English itself, it's like a third person is there on site and narrating that for us. So it's like is that the correct way to understand the text?
So there's some subtle points here, but in general, you know, when the Buddha, after some time, when the Buddha had his group of disciples, including the first five disciples, and then they had brought some other disciples of theirs, after they had left the Buddha, they had developed some disciples. So the small group, and the group got larger and larger. So at a certain point, it was deemed that the Buddha needed some assistant, you know, someone to help him with his daily needs. So many, you know, sort of like Roger Kunzang for Lama Zopa, you know, or, you know, I don't know if Geshe Zopa has attendant or someone. So there was one monk who volunteered, named Ananda, who was actually related to Shakyamuni. He was also from the royal court, just as these first five disciples were. Four of them were sons of these Brahmins that had made prophecy about the Buddha, and one of them was the youngest of them. Ananda was also cousin of the Buddha, and said, I will do, but a certain requirement, you know. He made certain things that had to happen. I can't remember all of them, but about food and about the Buddha's clothing and things like this. But one thing he said, whenever the Buddha gives discourse, I have to be there. Or if I missed one of the discourses, whoever was there has to relate to me what was said. And at that point, although writing existed, of course, this is only 500 BC in India, of course, Sanskrit was a written language also, but most of the scholarly transmission of knowledge in the Vedas also was done orally. So people would listen and memorize. They had very sharp minds, more than, because we don't exercise our memory. So Ananda either heard the earlier, before he became the attendant, either he was there and heard the earlier discourses, or if there were some that he was not present at, he heard from others. So that beginning of all of the sutras, how does it go in Sanskrit, do you know? How does that phrase go at the beginning of the sutras in Sanskrit? I can't remember the exact. Evam something sutram, thus I have heard. Evam, like, you know, the very famous word, thus. There's some other word. Sutram means heard. Shrutam. So what that means is that at the passing of the Buddha, there was a convocation of all the monastics, very distraught, but they wanted to rehearse all of the teachings that the Buddha had. That means to listen again, for someone to recite all, the Buddha said this at this time, then he said this, so that it would be shared with all of the monastics, all of the Sangha, so there would be that common knowledge. And it was Ananda's responsibility to recite all of these general sutras, because he was the one that had taken that responsibility. So he began each of his recitations of the Buddha's discourses with that, saying, thus I have heard at one time. It's not like we have, what do you say, we tell your kids bedtime stories, what do you say? Once upon a time, right? So the once is not exactly the same in his, thus did I heard at one time. The one time is not talking about once, like once upon a time. You know, it's not like imaginary or something. That the Buddha gave this discourse at a particular location and time, and it is in this way that I'm going to recite to you that I heard it. Either I heard it directly, or I heard it from others that were present. So that phrase generally indicates, and of course, even then, it was only passed on orally, generally. So it was not till some 400 years later, maybe around 100 BC, at the time of King Ashoka in India, that the king called a convocation of the Sangha, and mainly the Theravada, what was then understood to be the Theravada and some other variants of that. It didn't generally involve, the convocation wasn't so much involving bodhisattvas, but mainly the main teachings that the Buddha gave that were shared by the hearers, the solitary realizers, and the bodhisattvas. And the king had a daughter and one or two sons. I can't remember. Who knows? One or two sons. The king had become a Buddhist, King Ashoka. He'd been very fierce-like before. He'd been one of the big kings of India, and had reached some great status. But at one of his battles, supposedly he'd seen a soldier being attacked by someone on horseback, and the person with their sword cut at the person and missed the person, but cut the belly of the horse, who fell to the ground. It was a female horse who was pregnant, and the baby, who was what do you call foal or whatever baby, is just coming out of the mother's, and as she's dying, her last effort is to lick the body of the baby. And he thought, you know, even dying, even animals have compassion for others, you know. And so that is a culmination, having been exposed to the Buddhist teaching. Suddenly, sometimes there's some little spark that brings about some determination or some realization. So he decided to become really an authentic Buddhist, and spread the Buddhist teachings, put up pillars in various places, stupas, long story about Ashoka. In previous life, even have at the time of the Buddha, was a little boy who made offerings to the Buddha that created the karma to be able to do these amazing things. And so he asked that all of the teachings now be engraved on copper plates for the first time, sort of maybe to, what would that be like today? Rather than printing it, putting it on DVD, right? Or digital, you know, some kind of media that would withstand the ages rather than just writing on paper. And those teachings, that compendium of the baskets of the Buddhist teachings, the Tripitaka, the three baskets, they were brought to Sri Lanka, where his daughter and either one son or two sons, I can't remember, they went to, and they brought a small cutting from the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, and they tried to institute the Buddhist teachings in Sri Lanka, which have flowered till now. So that's when it was kind of renowned to have been written down, but of course, engraving them in copper plates, it could have been that they were written any time between the time that Ananda recited them and the time they were written on copper plates. It could have been written on paper or parchment or other things, but that's the renowned time they were supposedly first entrusted to some form which was beyond just memory. Because up till then, the teachings were transmitted orally from teacher to disciple who would memorize it. And then when that disciple grew older, they would pass it on to their disciples orally. Okay. Nowadays, we still enshrine that when we talk about receiving the oral transmission of teachings. And so there's something special, some more blessing in receiving a teaching from someone who has heard that teaching, not just read about it or read an article in the web or something like that, has heard that teaching from a teacher who has heard it from their teacher all the way back to the time it was first given, either by the Buddha or, you know, if you talk about even given teachings by Nagarjuna, you try to find a lineage that goes back to who Nagarjuna taught, who Chandratirthi taught, and so forth. Does that clear up your question? Or does that answer your question a little bit? Okay. Oh, this is good. Maybe this is worthwhile. Anything else? Okay. Oh, you have another. Yeah. Oh, you need to have. Okay. You should be sitting in the middle so you don't have to. Because he's so polite, he walks around in a big circle. I would just go straight across.
Hi, Venerable. So my other question is about the tree turning wheel. The tree turning... The tree... What?
Yeah.
Tree turning wheel of the Dharma, right?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, this tree turning wheel of the Dharma...
Turnings... Of the wheels.
Of the wheel. Yeah. Yeah. It sounds so funny. Three turnings of the wheel of the Dharma.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, so what actually happened? Is it that Buddha actually gave a series of teachings all his life, different topics, and then people collate it and then classify into the three? Is that how it happens? That's why we have three turnings, because it doesn't mean that Buddha only gave three teachings, right?
No.
It gave a series of teachings.
So my ear still hasn't gotten used to Singlish, so I missed some of the words you said, but
okay.
So there are different interpretations. Generally, if you were to be a teacher in a school, you might give various teachings to students of various capacities. And to those students, you would say, like say if you were teaching mechanics to some guys, you know, how to fix cars, how to fix machines, in America, we used to have different streams in our high schools. There was a vocational education, where you would learn a trade or mechanics or something. There were general studies, and then there were sometimes advanced placement courses, you know, for people of different. So even in the vocational subjects, the students were meant to, came to believe, rightly so, that what they were studying was of the utmost value and importance for themselves and for society and so forth. The same way the Buddha taught various levels of teachings during his lifespan. Some of the teachings were more geared to those who did not have the imprint in their mind from previous lives to enter the bodhisattva path right now. And those were teachings that he gave to the hearers, what were called the hearers, the shravakas, and the pratyeka Buddhas. That's generally what's considered to be the first churning of the wheel of Dharma, starting with the first discourse to Asvajit and the other five disciples at Deer Park. That's called the first churning. So that didn't take place only then. It's not that that discourse itself being the first is called the first churning of the wheel, but all of the subsequent teachings that he gave over the years that were aimed for those particular disciples based on the Four Noble Truths, how oneself can find real liberation, real moksha. You know what moksha means? I'm not saying mokka. You might be thinking mokka if you're, you know. See? Oh, moksha. Moksha is the Indian word. Sounds like mocha, but it means it's another synonym of, it's kind of a synonym of nirvana. It may have meant in certain Indian traditions at the time slightly different meaning than nirvana, but from a Buddhist point of view, it's a synonym. Liberation from cyclic existence, passing beyond sorrow, nirvana. They're all referring to the same thing from the Buddhist point of view. So for those individuals who might be aware, because many of the hearers and solitary realizers, the Shravakas and Pratika Buddhists, they listened to the Bodhisattva discourses, let's say on that the Buddha began to give on Vulture's Peak, Rajagriha. That's usually considered to be the second turning of the wheel of Dharma. So that doesn't mean it was the second time he taught. It just means the second time he began a new set of discourses that were aimed now for a different group of people, mainly the bodhisattvas. And even among the bodhisattvas, primarily toward the Arya bodhisattvas, how to practice the perfection of wisdom and complete bodhisattva perfections and achieve Buddhahood. So some of the disciples, the Hinayana's disciples, were there for those also. Like, for instance, during the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra, you've heard of the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra is considered a Mahayana Sutra, Prajnaparamita, professional wisdom. So it's the second turning of the wheel. But who is the person who asks the first question? Shariputra. Had that intimate relationship with Asvajit, who asked Asvajit, who's your teacher? I must find him. Now, after that experience with Asvajit, having heard that verse, Shariputra went back to Maghalyana, and they set off to find the Buddha. And even when they're coming, the Buddha said to his disciples, here are coming my two main disciples. He knew already. So Shariputra was considered among the disciples to be the foremost hearer in wisdom. You know, the one who excelled all others in wisdom. Maha Moggallana was foremost in what? You know? What? Magical power, right? This, the riddhis, the, you know, ability to do miraculous things, clairvoyance. And when Shariputra needed to have something known by clairvoyance, he would go to his friend. But Shariputra was considered to be the ultimate, the foremost in wisdom among among Buddha's disciples. So it's telling that he, at this point, on Vulture's Peak, in the Buddha's presence, he is inspired by the Buddha to ask Avalokiteshvara, who is not one of the hearers. Avalokiteshvara is known to be one of the bodhisattvas. He's asking Avalokiteshvara, hey, by the way, how do the bodhisattvas practice their perfection of wisdom? Because he knew how he practiced from the first turning of the wheel, how to practice wisdom that the Buddha taught in the first turning of the wheel. Well, how did the bodhisattvas practice the perfection of wisdom? How do they course in the perfection of wisdom? And Avalokiteshvara said, the bodhisattvas meditate on the emptiness of the aggregates also, is the first thing he said. So generally in the first turning of the wheel, geared for those who are aiming for nirvana, who don't yet have, they might admire the bodhisattva ideal, and they even come to listen to those teachings. It's like right now, you might admire a tantric teaching, so you go to hear them, but you know you're not ready to practice them. So how did the bodhisattvas practice the perfection of wisdom? He said, Avalokiteshvara said, they meditate on the emptiness of the aggregates also, because in the Theravada, in the first turning of the wheel, the Buddha mainly taught, when you talk about selflessness, as Geshe Dorje was saying, selflessness, emptiness generally are synonyms, but when the Buddha talked in the first turning of the wheel, he just talked about anatma, or anatta in Pali. Do you know how Pali works? Do you know what Pali language is? Pali was one of the vernacular languages of India at the time. It's a little bit like in ancient Rome, the noble people spoke what? Latin, right? Not really say Italian. I thought you were going to say Italian. They spoke Latin, very precise. The common people spoke Romano, which is essentially the common language, and the sort of slang, not all the proper grammar. There was maybe something in their schools, they had their own kind of grammar. They didn't pronounce it exactly the same as perfect Latin. Same thing in India. Pali was mirrored on Sanskrit, but it didn't have the exact pronunciation. Say, for instance, words like we often say from the Mahayana, from the Sanskrit, we say dharma. You've heard like we said the mantra, om ye dharma hetum, dharma, dharma. But in Pali, you know what it is in Pali? Dhamma. It's instead of R-A, D-H-R-M-A, with the two different consonants, they replaced the in words that, because it's a little difficult to change the tongue from dharma, to change from that. It's more easy when you're speaking quickly, colloquially, to say dhamma, the same syllable twice. So many, many words are like that in Pali. Oh, anatta, yeah. So, anatma. Atma means self, right? When the Buddhists taught there was no self, generally the letter A as a prefix means no. If the word the word you're adding it to begins in A, like atma, instead of A, you use an. Anatma means no self. Okay. But in Pali, because the N of an is followed by an atma. Oh, no, I would still say anatta, because the T of atma is followed by M, atma, that was changed to atta. So instead of atma in Pali, we say instead of atma in Sanskrit, we say atta in Pali. So anatma becomes anatta. So when the Buddha taught anatta or anatma in the first turning of the wheel, he mainly taught it about the person, that there's no findable person. Generally, the implication is that the person appears to be permanent and partless, and well, there's more subtlety to it than that, that if you really check, there is no such atma as the non-Buddhist schools had proposed and so forth. There's anatma, anatta. They didn't talk about the emptiness or the selflessness of the mug or of other phenomena or the body. But Avalokiteshvara said, the Bodhisattvas, you know, when Shariputra asked, how do the Bodhisattvas meditate on this perfection of wisdom? He said, the Bodhisattvas meditate. So I'll add some extra words. Not only do the Bodhisattvas meditate on the emptiness of the self, but they meditate on the emptiness of the basis upon which the self is imputed, the aggregates. They too, all of these things, are also empty of inherent existence. They meditate on the emptiness of inherent existence of the aggregates also, not just on the emptiness of the self. So those teachings that talk about that kind of emptiness are called the second turning of the wheel of Dharma. At a later time, the Buddha taught teachings that were later enshrined, mainly called the teachings of the third wheel of Dharma, third wheel of the turning of the Dharma, that often talked about Buddha nature, that were the basis for a certain number of other Mahayana sutras that had a slightly different interpretation of emptiness. So those three sets of discourses, and those individuals for whom they were aimed, so the first turning of the wheel mainly aimed for those who were aiming for nirvana, from the general presentation of Mahayana, the second turning of wheel was mainly meant for the Arya Bodhisattvas who were practicing the perfection of wisdom. Third turning of the wheel was meant, depends on whether you accept them, the third turning of the wheel as being the highest turning or not. If you believe it's the highest turning, then it was for some exceptional disciples. If you believe, as is the general consensus, that the third turning of the wheel was meant for people who could not, aspired to the second wheel of the turning of the wheel of Dharma, but they could not fathom it completely. So it was somehow teaching other teachings within the context of teaching emptiness a little bit more simplified. So that's what's meant by the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma from the Mahayana point of view. Okay? Does that help?
So actually my question...
Oh, sorry, I didn't answer your question.
Yeah, you did answer my question, but my second more important question has not been expressed yet. So my question is about the last turning wheel of the Dharma. Last turning of the wheel of the Dharma. The last turning, I understand from some schools, is the final view of the Buddha. For us, is the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma is the final view for us. But for other schools, like what I meant is like Kagyu or you know, those schools, apparently they presented the last turning, the last
the third turning of the wheel, yeah, of Dharma. The Dharma is the ultimate.
Yeah. And I think it has to do with the fact that in that turning of the wheel, not only the way we understand is that Buddha actually teach the Chittamatris, the mind only school view over there, but I think for them, I think for the last turning, I think Buddha also teach Buddha nature.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah. So,
Tathagata
essence, yeah.
So, I mean, so it's not as though the other Tibetan schools all believe the third turning of the wheel is the ultimate intent of the Buddha. One might get that impression because the second turning of the wheel is said to be the actual more precise explanation of the first turning. You might get the impression then the third turning of the wheel would be refining the second wheel and giving better interpretation. Many Kagyu, Sakya, Nyingma scholars, maybe even the majority, believe the second turning of the wheel to be the final intention of the Buddha. That the third, but some fits into some presentation of Mahamudra presentation by some Kagyus and Drigun Kagyu, other kinds, and other people, and other, some of the scholars fits into their presentation of Mahamudra Dzogchen, that there is another interpretation of emptiness that supposedly is more profound. But the general view, probably of most Kagyu, you know, if you ask the Karmapa or, you know, others, they will say the second wheel of, the second turning of the wheel of Dharma is the ultimate intent of the Buddha. The third wheel was for, in a sense, for those, to expose some other teachings of the Buddha about the Buddha nature. You've heard of Buddha nature, right? Say, Tathagata Garbha. The Garbha is like womb, or the matrix from which the Tathagatas rise. We all have within us Buddha nature. And because of that, we all have the capacity to become Buddha, and we all eventually will we all eventually will become Buddha. In presenting that Tathagata Garbha, the way the similes are given in one of the great presentations, and Geshe-la was mentioning that in his teachings the other night, you know, like the gold is in the ground, but you don't notice it because it is obscured by the dirt, or golden statue that is covered in mud and so forth. It's almost as though we are already Buddha, but we don't know it. As you might take that interpretation and say, you might say that's one way of giving an example of the third turning of the wheel of Dharma. But from the point of view of the second wheel of turning of Dharma, second turning of the wheel of Dharma, it doesn't make sense. If we're already Buddha and we don't know it, it's like, what kind of Buddha is that? Right? How can you be omniscient? How can you be already Buddha, omniscient mind, and not know it? So anyway, that's much more subtle and sophisticated, how do you say, contradictions to that. But it's not that all Kagyu accept the third turning wheel, or that all other Buddhists accept the third turning of the wheel as the final intention of the Buddha. But it did propose another set of teachings talking about Buddha nature, maybe more from the experiential point of view, because it was the origin of a lot of these teachings of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, which is one of the famous, Dzogchen is Tibetan words. It's you know, how to achieve this realization of emptiness in a practical sense, in a yogic meditative sense. So in cases like that, sometimes the subtleties of philosophy are separated to try to have some experience. You might even call, like when we meditate, We were meditating on the clear light nature of the mind earlier. Try to get some feeling. Let go of your thoughts. After some times the thoughts come and you notice they disappear and you get the feeling that the mind itself is like a space. Thoughts can appear in it. They can be removed from it. They can dissipate. And the states of mind themselves are not part and parcel of the basic nature of our mind. Attachment is not part of our nature, although when you talk about the popular, I don't say popular press, but popular idea, people think, oh, anger is part of our nature. You shouldn't try to, you know, remove, you shouldn't try to feel, feel bad about anger. It's our nature. Attachment is our nature. Well, right now it's our nature because it's coming up because of causes. The karma that we created in the past. But it can be removed. It's not that state of mind when the causes for its generation are uprooted, then the plant above, you know, when you uproot the plant, even though the greens are still there for a time, you know, sitting on the ground, because they get no nutrition, they dry up and disappear. So, yeah, to get a feeling of that, of that clear light nature of the mind. Sometimes in some of the Mahamudra traditions, it's said that, oh, you are now experiencing the ultimate nature of the mind, which sort of accords, in a sense, sort of sounds like the third turning of the wheel of Dharma. The kind of, if you interpret the similes as being explicitly talking about reality, not just similes, like, but being, you know. When you remove the dirt, there's the Buddha there altogether. So when you remove the thoughts, there's Buddhahood. There's the omniscient mind right there. But in general, many of the scholars, Nyingma, Kargyu, Sakya, Gelug, all of the Buddha, when we talk about the Tibetan traditions, they say, no, it's not, that's only pointing to the conventional nature of the mind. And that these preliminary teachings that Saraha and others gave on Mahamudra, they weren't talking about, when they talked about this, looking at this luminosity of the mind, at first, it was just the object upon which you develop single-pointed concentration on the nature, conventional nature of the mind, and then you meditate on the emptiness of that. Meditate on the emptiness of the mind. That's the real Mahamudra, the emptiness of the mind, not just the clarity. But that yogic method, because it's so effective, looking at the mind itself, using the mind to look at itself rather than looking at other things. That it became, you know, that sometimes this whole thing about the third wheel of Dharma becoming, being the final intention of the Buddha, that sort of comes about a little bit in relationship to that, I think. There may be other reasons, but now some of you, you're not interested in all of these details, but maybe some of you, just for the sake of, some of you may have been interested. So, we talked a little bit about different details about the Four Noble Truths. They're called truths for Arya beings. That's kind of the meaning. It's not as though the truths themselves are noble, right? They're called noble truths because they're truth for noble beings. Noble is a translation of the word Arya, which means people who have realized reality as it actually exists, those who have realized emptiness as it actually exists. for those individuals, these are no longer just suppositions or that you're something you're confident about, but you've realized directly. One factor we didn't mention was the so say it like this. What comes first? Well, I was going to say what comes first, the chicken or the egg, but that's not a good one. What comes first, the mother or her child? Well, I should say mother, the eventual mother. I'm not trying to be semantically, I'm just trying to say, what comes first, a cause or its effect? Do effects come, does the smoke come before the fire? And then the fire comes? The smoke causes the fire? No, oh, come on. Only in America would someone say something like that, right? Would you say that causes always precede their effects? No? What do you think? Do you know what I mean by cause and effect? Cause and result? Causes always come before the results, right? The cause comes, fire, then the smoke comes. The woman who is going to give birth is there first. She has to be there as a substratum, as a cause to give birth to the baby, right? You can talk about other things. But so in the Four Noble Truths, first of all, the Buddha talked about, the very first thing he talked about was suffering. And then he talked about the cause of suffering. So some over the centuries, in the millennia, when people would debate about Buddhist teachings, some people would say, oh, the Buddha got it wrong. He got the order wrong. He should have said the cause of suffering, because causes always come first, is the first noble truth, and then the truth of suffering. That's the result, right? What do you think? Did the Buddha get it wrong? Probably not, right? You have some confidence you probably didn't get it. But why? What was the purpose in teaching the result first and then the cause? First truth is the result, suffering, and then taught about the cause. So in many of the commentaries on the Four Noble Truths, it mentions that a doctor, when you go to see the doctor, you come with some particular ailment. You know, my sore throat, or it turns out it looks like mild bronchitis, in case you're interested. A doctor did a little x-ray and checked, and said it's nothing serious. A couple more days, you should be okay. So first you come with the suffering, and then they use their expertise to determine what the cause of that suffering is, right? And then if there is a solution, and it's not always a solution, maybe you're going to die, but if there is a solution, they say, look, there is a, we can get rid of that. That would be what? Truth of cessation, right? You know, we can get a, and here's the method, here's the procedure, the path you have to follow to get rid of that. So it's said that the Buddha was incredibly skillful when he taught the Four Noble Truths, because he taught it like in the same way that a doctor treats a patient, first noting, and maybe the patient doesn't even notice that they're suffering. Maybe the doctor does some examination and says, you've got a growth growing here, or something else is happening. You have a fever, you don't know it. First is noted the suffering, and then the cause of the suffering. And then is proposed the possibility of alleviating that so that one has enthusiasm to follow the procedure. If you just say there's a procedure, I'm going to give you a procedure. You say, why do I want to take all that bad medicine? Well, because it will cease the disease. So you tell them, first of all, that it's possible to cease this, to have the truth of cessation, and that the truth of the path is like the procedure that you must follow in order to alleviate that suffering. So that of the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, the Four Noble Truths fall into the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, which is mainly meant for those that were intent on escaping from cyclic existence, from samsara, for themselves. They still had the great arhats, the great beings of the hearer and solitary realizer lineages. They did have compassion. They did have, even in the Abhidharma, they even had great compassion, but they didn't have the great compassion of the bodhisattvas. That is to say, they had compassion for other people who were suffering. And in turn, when they called Maha Karuna, you know what Karuna means? What does Karuna mean? Karuna, Indian word that means compassion, right? It's the word, Tibetan word, we say ningje, or, you know, when we talk about compassion and wisdom, Karuna. I have a friend named Karuna in America, Karuna Kaden. So when the Hinayana, when the hearer and solitary realizers talk about great compassion, Maha Karuna, what they meant was compassion even for the rich, even for the powerful, those who are enjoying right now. Sometimes in our ordinary worldly life, we might think, there's no, you know, how can you have, there's no need to have compassion for them. They've got it all, right? But from the point of view of the lesser vehicle, the hearers and solitary realizers, when they talk about Maha Karuna, great compassion, they say the hearers and solitary realizers, you shouldn't say the hearers and solitary realizers don't have compassion. They not only have compassion, they have great compassion, they say. But their interpretation of great compassion is they have compassion for every degree of suffering. The obvious suffering of suffering, compassion for changeable suffering, which we generally think of as happiness, samsaric contaminated happiness. And they have compassion for those who are experiencing all pervasive compounded suffering, this third most subtle kind of suffering. But in the Mahayana, the Bodhisattva's meaning of Maha Karuna is different. The meaning of Maha Karuna is a compassion that cannot bear the suffering of others and makes a decision to alleviate that suffering by themselves. Takes the responsibility to alleviate that suffering for themselves, by themselves. The Hinayana arhats, the Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas, don't make that kind of resolution. They feel bad that they're suffering, and they experience all of that, but they feel, I've got to get out of this place. There was a song, did I mention that the other day? There was a song in my earlier days, it was already probably 50 years ago or 45 years ago, it was, who sang it? We got to get out of this place. Eric Burton and the Someone's, I can't remember. Have you heard that song? We got to get out of this place if it's the last thing we ever do. I don't know what it was referring to. Maybe some place where you couldn't dance or something. But that, to me, that's a good theme song that kind of explains the mindset of the Hinayana arhat. But it mainly, the Hinayana arhats thought is, I've got to get out of this place. We've got to get out of this place is more the theme song of the Bodhisattva. So putting off their own escape from cyclic existence to take everyone along with them. Okay, makes sense. So this is a little introduction to the Four Noble Truths. And in the succeeding weeks, when on this Saturday series, when we talk about other subjects, we'll make allusion back to this, and in the other courses also. So in the, if you think about the subject and you have questions in the coming days, we'll also, I think starting this week or next week, I'll also try to make some time available. If you want to have a personal consultation or something like that, you can come and we can meet, have a cup of tea, and you can ask your questions. But also save your questions for coming classes. And let's end now with just a couple minutes of dedication, because I had mentioned before, or maybe I didn't say explicitly, there are three important times: the beginning, the middle, and the end. So at the beginning of any action, the most important thing is the motivation. It will give the impetus to your action, whether it becomes virtuous or non-virtuous. Your mind may even get angry in the middle of the action. Say in the middle of the discourse, I might say some stupid things and you get irritated or you get angry or something. But because of your good motivation in the beginning, it forms a general channel for that action that gives the tenor, the taste, the flavor of that to be virtuous or non-virtuous. In the middle, that means when the action is being done, let's say listening to the teaching or meditating or doing prostrations or whatever, you try to do it in a concentrated way to keep your mind focused and to do it in a way that is doesn't fall into any of the faults of that meditation or practice. At the end, it's not as though you finish the practice and you're, okay, I'm off, got to go to yoga. You try to dedicate the merits that you have motivated. You motivated at the beginning to create some special flavor, some inertia for the whole practice. Then you do that practice on the basis of that motivation, and at the end you realize that you've created some virtuous karma during that action, presumably, and in order to preserve that karma and to increase it, you make a special kind of prayer that's called dedication. Generally, prayer doesn't necessarily link up, you know, the merits that you created and a result. General prayer means, you know, may this come about. May all sentient beings be happy. May I become a Buddha. May I solve my problems. May, you know, the world be happy, and so forth. A dedication is a kind of prayer in which you say, due to these causal factors, these virtuous karmas or karma that I've created, may they ripen in a particular way. And you might think, well, how can you decide how the karma is going to ripen? Because it may not be under our control. Well, it is under our control to a certain degree. In the same way, when you ride a horse, if you don't hold the bridle, is that the right term for the... If you don't hold the bridle, just let the horse do its own thing. It may gallop off, go down to the clover field, roll around in the mud. You know, you might get crushed. In the same way, if you don't dedicate the merits, they will ripen in their own way. But it may not bring any benefit to you and other sentient beings. It might ripen in, say, for instance, if you give generosity, make charity, you create some virtuous karma. If you don't dedicate those, it may ripen in the future. It will ripen in something that is pleasant. You may have wealth. But that wealth itself may become the cause of your pride. You know, there are some people who are wealthy, and it doesn't make them better people. Have you ever encountered people like that? Sometimes they worry about it. Anyone's trying to get their money, or they have to protect it, or they become more stingy than people of more modest means. If you become very humble, if you practice humility in this lifetime, and respect for your elders, your teachers, your mother and father, you create the karma to be held in high esteem in future lives. But if you don't dedicate that merit, you may be born in a very high position, but it becomes a cause of your pride. Does that happen sometime? You know, people of noble families or politicians or something. I can think of one in America right now. But I won't mention any names. So we try to dedicate the merits like we're like taking the reins of the horse rather than letting it go down to the clover fields or to the mud bath. We take it to the goal of liberation and enlightenment. So we think, due to these merits, they're going to ripen in some way positive in the future. You could say, I dedicate them to my future enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings, to that final goal. But I like to think something more incremental for it also, to think all the stages of the path that lead up there. Due to these merits, may I develop, you know, more satisfaction this lifetime, patience, an affability with others, you know, a sort of acceptance of others' faults, and a sense of joy and happiness in their happiness. And in successive lives, whatever way this karma ripens, because it doesn't ripen just once, may it always become the cause of my spiritual development, day by day, week by week, life by life, up until including, may it eventually become the cause of my achieving enlightenment for my own sake, totally chilled out, you know, totally blissful, like nirvana, but like the Buddha's great bliss, and not just for myself alone. From that standpoint, may I be able to spontaneously and effortlessly act to bring about the welfare of all sentient beings, even those that I now consider enemies or strangers, certainly loved ones. So let's try to dedicate the merit something like that right now. Sit comfortably. Recall that we tried to generate at the beginning a positive motivation to take part in the class this morning. And think, the actions that I've created today, concentrating, paying attention with an open mind, with the intention of healing myself, becoming a better person for others, I've definitely created some virtuous karma which will ripen as happiness within cyclic existence. But at first, it will ripen as contaminated happiness. And contaminated happiness, if not linked to some other goal, may just be experienced by itself alone with some self-satisfaction, not having any great import, any great importance, not having any great value. In whatever way this virtue ripens, may it become a cause of my continued practice. If I become wealthy, may I use it to benefit others. May I use my wealth not for pride or miserliness, but may I spontaneously use it to propagate the Dharma, to find conditions for others to practice the Dharma. If I have high position, may it not become a cause of pride and arrogance, but may I use it to influence others to practice the Dharma, those that look up to me, that use my position as a moral, you know, standard by which others can practice. In whatever way my virtues ripen in the future as a result of these virtues that I've created, may it become the cause of my continued Dharma practice, life by life, up until my practice of the Bodhisattva path and the achievement of enlightenment for the principally sought for, not just for my own pleasure, but principally sought as the perfect solution to bring about the alleviation of suffering of all sentient beings. Due to these merits, may I become a Buddha for the sake of all living beings. You get a little flavor of that. Try to hold that flavor, that sense of determination. You're as though you've received a, like say a secular example, if you received an income tax back from the government or so your aunt left you some money or something, you make a, you dedicate it. I'm going to use this for my retirement or for my children's education or making a very strong determination due to these merits, may they ripen in this way. Okay, thank you very much. So thanks for coming. Nice to see you again. Hope to see you again either tomorrow or Tuesday, Thursdays, or next week at this time. Thanks so much.